Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Personal Finance Podcast. I'm Deputy Personal Finance Editor Kate Bearley, and I'm here with Personal Finance Editor Leonora Walters and Personal Finance Writer Emma Ajman. And on the phone, we have Mihir Kapadia, CEO of wealth management firm Sun Global. So today we're going to discuss very topical issues. We're going to look at how the interest rate cut affects your portfolio, whether the Olympics means anything for investing in Brazil. And we're also going to talk more widely about why emerging market equities and emerging market debt have been such great trades this year. But first of all, we're going to go to the rate cut. So last week, the Bank of England cut the interest rate for the first time since 2009 and boosted the QE programme. Now, that might be good news for borrowers, but it's certainly bad news for savers as interest on cash and income from investments takes another hit. So, Leonora, what does this mean for anyone holding cash?
Basically, in large part, lower rates. Following the interest rate cut, a number of banks, some of which you can see in this week's money section, have cut their rates on bank accounts and ISAs, and that includes some big names like HSBC and Santander. Though, interestingly, this morning, if you're an existing customer of a Nationwide, you're not actually going to experience a cut, and the Flexclusive Regular Saver maintains its interest rate at 5%. The Flex One Regular Saver maintains its interest rate at 3.5%, and the Nationwide Help to Buy ISA maintains its rate at 2%. But I think that's the exception rather than the rule.
So there's quite a big kind of variation then in the rate cuts and whether people.
Well, I'd say I think the Nationwide's a notable exception. I think for the most part it's going to be cuts.
But I mean, does that mean there's no point holding cash at all?
Absolutely not. No. Depending on your circumstances, you may have a need for cash. Where if you're a young saver, and you've got a good job, perhaps you don't need a lot. But if you're older, if you're retired in particular, you probably need a good chunk. Even if you're running a portfolio, a balanced portfolio has to include cash. And even if you're in work, you should have at least 3 to 6 months' salary in easily accessible cash for emergencies, aka redundancy, illness, or a number of other things. So it is absolutely essential that everyone has more or less cash.
Okay. Now, we've obviously looked at savings and we look across the kind of your money spectrum. So who is set to lose out the most from this rate cut and why?
Well, probably pensioners and people in retirement, because they're possibly living off interest from cash savings. And I think a large group is going to be negatively affected. People, let's say, about to buy an annuity, because annuity rates are linked to gilts, UK government bonds and interest rates. And obviously, if this comes down, you'll get a worse annuity rate. If you locked into one already, that's, I suppose, not so bad. But people coming up to buying annuity, not good.
Annuities, which have not been looking appealing for some time.
No.
And bonds used to be the go-to for income investors, didn't they? And has that changed now? Is that not the case anymore?
No. I mean, they're not paying such attractive rates. I mean, it's been starting, obviously, UK government bonds. I mean, they're most, I suppose, closely linked. So, they'll come down as well. But corporate bonds, I mean, they benchmark off gilts. So, even if, the company's not related, to the UK or whatever, because it's benchmarking off a gilt, the rates on corporate bonds will also come down.
Okay, so if you're looking at equities for income, then which are the kind of most appealing sectors?
Probably equity income. Now, before you rush into equity income, you do have to remember what your risk appetite is. It may not be suitable for everybody to go into equities. Equities are not a direct substitute for bonds, and most certainly not a direct substitute for cash. But if you have a reasonable risk appetite and you've got a reasonable time horizon, let's say at least 5 years, then yes, you could consider equity. And equity income is the obvious area to go. I think what's good about it is, while it's not necessarily the same as bonds, equity income shares often get described as bond proxies because they pay steady regular dividends, and the companies that pay them are a lot less volatile. They're typically very large, very stable, don't grow much, but certainly aren't going to go bust and have regular earnings coming in so we can pay you your dividend. And good examples would be companies in the healthcare sector like GlaxoSmithKline and AstraZeneca, tobacco companies like Imperial Tobacco and British American Tobacco, and consumer staples companies like Unilever. And if you are particularly interested in the issue of equity income, a week today, our economist Chris Dillow has a very interesting comment on the properties of defensive shares, such as these bond proxies in the Portfolio Clinic.
Okay, so the bond proxies sound quite good. Does that mean investors don't even need to hold bonds?
Not at all. I think most people should have a balanced portfolio, so you definitely shouldn't exclude bonds from it. I mean, they will still provide some income. They also balance out the risk of a portfolio. They're not necessarily correlated with equities. So, you know, if equities are tanking, perhaps your bonds will do better. And you need different elements in the portfolio to, I suppose, mitigate downside.
Okay, great. So we've got some more tips on what the rate cut means for your portfolio in the magazine this week. But somewhere else likely to be affected by this rate cut is emerging markets, as this cut is likely to continue spurring on one of the year's most popular trades, and it's emerging market equities and emerging market debt. So money's been flooding back there since the start of the year, and that's due to a sentiment shift towards many of those countries, but also because you can just get far better returns on those than anywhere else now without paying more, often paying less, and without, in many cases, taking much more risk. So the most timely areas when it comes to EM now are Brazil and Latin America, obviously as a result of the Olympics and because of some major political shifts in those regions, but also India, which has been rallying following a major reform last week. So Mihir, how do you explain the surge in emerging market equities more generally since the start of the year? Why is it suddenly so popular?
Well, emerging markets have been fairly cheap a lot since last year. They were battered, of course, post the problems out of China, and in the months between August and October last year, the global markets were affected and emerging markets were deeply impacted. What that did was it created a fair amount of value in those regions. Countries like Brazil suffered a lot at that time because they are commodity-dependent countries, and major companies are dependent on commodity prices. Having corrected significantly, and then on a relative to the so-called developed markets, they offered the highest amount of opportunity in terms of, when you talk about bonds, in terms of yields, and in equities in terms of value. And with the ongoing problems in Europe, lack of much reform or changes in Japan, U.S. Really has been the only major market which has been keeping the markets going, and it has obviously become a lot more expensive, and hence the reignition of interest for emerging markets, especially LATAM. And some parts of Asia.
Okay, so we've got quite a few things there. We've got the rebound in commodities, we've got Brexit, and we've got the fact that they were beaten up so badly, I guess, up to last year and are now looking very cheap. And you mentioned Latin America there and Brazil. Now, Emma, our feature, our big theme this week is on Latin America and on Brazil and the Olympics. So what kind of returns are we seeing in Latin America? Is that really driving emerging market performance?
Yes, it is. We are seeing big rallies, as you've mentioned. So, for example, Brazil's stock market is up 74% this year, and that's compared to a loss of 39% last year. So that's a massive change and shift. And overall, the MSCI Emerging Markets Latin American Index is also up, and it's up by 43.9%. So these are big returns. And yes, it looks like this is definitely driving things forward in the emerging market space.
Okay, and what about the Olympics? I mean, are the Olympics having an impact here, particularly on Brazil, or is it something else that's driving this return?
Well, for sure, the Olympics has had an impact, and it could prove a further boost to the Brazilian economy going forward. But the analysts that we spoke to said that the market surges are mostly being driven by political change in the region. And in particular, lots of populist governments have fallen out of favour and now being replaced with more market-friendly governments. And so that is making investors more interested in the area and could be one of the reasons why these rallies have occurred. There are other plus points to consider. For example, you know, higher commodity prices is one thing that is probably having a positive impact. And the fact that the US has taken, its interest rates hasn't tightened. And so the fact that that is taking a lot longer to happen is also having a positive impact on the region.
But, I mean, and in Brazil specifically, did analysts feel that this was going to give a boost or is that kind of overly optimistic to think that just having a sporting event will drive the stock market up higher?
If history is anything to go by, Brazilian stock markets could experience a 25% boost because of the Olympics. So, for example, some work that the broker AJ Bell has done showed that countries that host the Olympics receive a big boost. But some commentators that we've spoken to said that, you know, the problem with Brazil is that it's got a whole range of other issues that may hold it back from experiencing that boost. So, for example, the fact that they've had poor execution of government policies in the past and it's been relatively an unfriendly area for investment means that could actually neutralise the impact that the Olympics could have. But I suppose it's a case of the jury's out on that one.
Okay, now we have just talked there a bit about all of the kind of political shift happening in Latin America. And Mihir, what do you think about this concept of investing based on the hope of political reform? I mean, when writing this piece, a number of people have referenced Narendra Modi's election in India and that kind of the hope for change there. Now, you were born in India, have run several businesses there and have launched an Indian ETF, which we'll come to. What would you say about this idea of investing based on the hope of reform? Is that sensible and how has it worked in India?
I think we can all, investors always invest in the hope of results in the forthcoming future. What we see about political reform, many of these countries in emerging markets, let's talk about India for a moment. They are actually very robust economies and have a huge consumer-driven market. Bulk of the issues and problems have come in the past because of red tape and with a lack of a fluid process of investments and flow of investment. When Narendra Modi was elected about 2 years ago, he came on the promise of huge amount of political reform, and Indian markets have benefited significantly. But during this process, there were no real major big bang reforms that he could have been appreciated for till the recent one, which was passed only recently last week, which is the goods and services tax, which is another form of obviously VAT. So this has streamlined a huge number of taxes. It will allow a flow of goods within India, which in itself is a huge country, but divided by multiple states, almost 28 odd states. There were a lot of tax and movement issues of goods within the country. And now it becomes a single market rather than it being a fragmented market. So yes, that is a very big development, very significant development. It should help both the consumers. It will reduce the cost of goods and also the various companies, because the goods, the cost of goods, production, transport, etc., will reduce significantly, and it will boost profitability across the board.
So you're saying on that basis, then maybe it is worth, because I mean the market's rallied, hasn't it? Following that reform, which I think some people have been calling the single most important structural reform for the country in 25 years. So I mean, on that basis, would you say that yes, it is a good idea to look at political change and invest accordingly, or is it pretty high risk as a strategy?
Well, it really depends on the pedigree of the government. There have been several such governments in the past who have promised a lot and delivered less. So one has to be always careful and look at the entire scenario to see how much of all of these things are achievable. But having seen in the recent run-up in the last couple of years, this particular government has shown a resolve to sort of be able to implement their promises. So as far as India is concerned at the moment, it's worked. I cannot say for sure for all the other countries.
Okay. And I want to move away from equities now and just look at emerging market debt. Now, emerging market debt has been a real standout trade this year. As with emerging market equities, money has really been flooding back in, and it is related to the fact that yields have fallen so far in the developed world. I mean, we've got negative yields across developed market bonds compared to yields of 5-6% in emerging market debt. But can this rally continue, and what are the risks and benefits? Mihir, how do you explain this surge in emerging market debt this year? Is it related to negative rates elsewhere?
Well, certainly. I think the global markets were used to some sort of a return expectation. But since the interest rate cuts and the ever-expanding balance sheets of the central bankers have forced so much liquidity in the developed markets, there's absolutely no return available on the on that debt. So what emerging markets are doing, whilst the risk is always there of currencies being debased and, you know, fall in the value of currency versus the global currency in these emerging markets, but there is a huge amount of upside and hence what we call the carry between the risk of fall in the currency versus the coupon or the yield available to investors. This has prompted a huge surge in investments into emerging market debt, at least since the beginning of this year.
And so how does the risk compare? Are you saying that the main risk is currency risk with emerging market debt? And how does that compare to the risk you take with a developed market bond, which is now very expensive?
So let's assume if you are a investor in Britain investing in gilts or British corporate debt, we obviously have no risk because we invested in sterling pounds and we are getting a coupon in the same. Now, compare that whether you invest in, say, Indian rupee debt, there the coupons available on sovereign at the moment is somewhere close to around 7.5% in Indian rupee. But if rupee depreciates more than 7.5% during the year, basically there's no return on your investment. And if it falls further, obviously there is a capital loss because you lost money in the currency. Having said that, post-Brexit, what we have seen is the fall in sterling has sort of actually given a huge return to the investors from Britain who invested in these emerging market currencies, for example, in the Indian bonds. If you had invested in Indian bonds at around 8% coupon at the beginning of this year, with the fall in currency, the return at the moment is somewhere in very high teens. And that really is the major difference.
Okay.
At this point of time.
But, and then another risk, obviously, is the Fed. I mean, we know from 2013 in that major emerging market crisis that emerging markets are very tied to what the Fed does. And at the moment, people think that the Fed is not planning to raise rates, you know, in the immediate future. But what if it does? What if the Fed surprises us with a sudden tightening cycle? What would happen then to this asset class?
Well, certainly there will be an impact. I think all major markets, and especially the emerging markets, always feel the impact of any decision by Federal Reserve, because that will have an immediate impact on dollar, which is the world's reserve currency and so-called go-to currency in terms in times of crisis. So certainly if and when the Federal Reserve decides to increase the interest rates, these emerging market currencies will have an immediate impact. But at this point of time, two things are happening. One, Federal Reserve has tried to make things very transparent and clear in terms of their intent and intention and in what precedent conditions would be before they would make this kind of a move. So they have sort of reduced a little bit of the surprise element. But what that has done is it has stabilize the market. What we see today, the volatility worldwide has stabilized significantly. And that is what is helping investor sentiments, and that is what is helping investors take that extra risk of going into emerging markets or even equities, which is on a higher risk scale. As far as emerging markets are concerned, the other thing is there is still a significant carry. There's still a large differential between interest rates, what they have in the home markets versus what's prevalent in the U.S. and Europe. So even if there is going to be an increase of, say, 0.25%, we don't expect that there will be a huge withdrawal for emerging markets in the immediate term. At this point of time, with the dollar having risen significantly over the last 3 months versus sterling and euro, really the impact of interest rate hike has already almost happened for US.
Okay. And I just want one final point on that, just on valuations. I mean, just how cheap are these compared to developed market bonds, or to how expensive are developed market bonds, would you say?
Well, quite frankly, developed market bonds today are offering, I mean, the so-called secured bonds, whether if we look at bonds or we look at gilts, they're practically offering us nothing. It's really a way to just protect and keep your cash. Emerging markets are offering a decent return, and that's really what it is. At this point of time, we believe that the European countries, apart from, say, Italy and Spain, there's nothing that really an investor can actually expect, at least for the medium term.
Okay, now I want to just talk a bit about the Indian bond ETF, which you have launched, I think, last year. So what is this? What's it designed to do? What's it invested in?
Sure. This particular ETF was launched at the end of last year. It's called Sunglobal Zaifin Indian Sovereign-Owned Companies ETF. This particular ETF is designed to invest in bonds of the companies which are significantly owned by the Indian government. So when I say significant, it's at least more than 53% shareholding of the Indian government. What we saw was an opportunity last year that the investors across the world did not really have any such product that would make it easy for them to invest in this in Indian bonds, in Indian rupee bonds, without really going through a huge amount of hassle. This particular ETF is listed in London, on the London Stock Exchange, as well as in Frankfurt, and trades in three different currencies, sterling, US dollar, as well as in euros. This ETF is investing across six or seven companies in India. All of these companies are very significant for the Indian economy because they are likes of utilities, national highway businesses, and the like. So extremely important companies which are locally rated AAA and are the proxy for Indian sovereign.
You were saying there just six. It's six bonds, isn't it? Six holdings. I think people would find that quite unusual. What would you say about people worried about the concentration risk there?
Well, look, this particular ETF is designed to invest in quasi-sovereign. So as far as concentration is concerned, certainly the concentration risk is on the Indian government anyway. That's number one. There is a higher amount of correlation to the fact that since they are all owned by the Indian government, if something happens to the Indian government, so your call is if there's an issue with India, only then these companies will have a problem. As far as we are concerned, the idea is not to invest only in six. We could invest up to eight or nine. But these are all Indian government-owned entities, and there are only so many that one could invest in with the kind of specific requirements that we have put in this particular index that we have created.
And what are those requirements? Because obviously people worry about liquidity, don't they? Is that a part of this selection process?
Sure. Yes, it is very much part of this selection process. Number one, they all have to be rated AAA locally. The minimum ownership of the government of India has to be at least 53% or higher. And most of the companies that we have invested in are much higher than 60% owned by the government of India. Third, we also look at, obviously, the liquidity in the local markets where these bonds trade. And these are the most highly traded bonds locally. The local market is over $1.5 trillion. And these particular bonds are one of the most liquid bonds in that particular market.
Although, does that mean if you're choosing the most liquid bonds, does that mean that you could end up with the most sold bonds, as in the bonds that everybody wants to get rid of in your portfolio? Is that a risk?
We basically, obviously, the portfolio is rebalanced every quarter. We look at, obviously, all sorts of risks. But as far as our risk profile is concerned, we make sure that we are invested in those companies which will continue to show the kind of strength that this particular index is looking at. The risk, of course, is that of Indian rupee depreciating because of whatever reason which we have already discussed just a little bit earlier.
Okay. And I guess an obvious question is why would UK investors want to have this exposure to Indian bonds? I mean, and how does it compare to holding a wider emerging market bond fund?
Well, to give you an analysis, this particular ETF, it gives you, first of all, an opportunity to invest in one of the fastest growing markets in the world. It is the fastest growing market in the last 2 years. And at this point of time, these companies are growing significantly. These are world-class companies that we invest in. The investor who had invested beginning from November end of last year when we actually launched this ETF in sterling term, this particular ETF in sterling term is up by almost 22%, slightly over 22% impact. Of course, since Brexit and the fall in sterling from almost 150 to 132 has certainly helped. But what it does is it allows the UK investors to diversify their investments, number one, and get the excellent carry which is offered by these securities. These securities, when we started investing, have been giving yields of around 8.25%. Even if you were to factor in that over the last 10 years, Indian rupee has depreciated by just under 3% every year, it gives you a nice carry of almost 5% in a market where today we absolutely have no interest or no return on our fixed income bonds in major equivalent companies in UK.
Yeah, okay. And just finally, I just want to ask your view on the new Turkish sovereign bond ETF, which launched, and that's been launched by Zyfin, which is you've partnered with on this Indian one. How would you say the risk of that compares to Indian bond? And what does current political tension in Turkey mean for investing in something like that?
This particular bond offering, this EBA bond ETF offering in Turkey, was being planned for almost a year before it was launched. There has been a huge amount of demand for it from several of our investors who have obviously a longer-term view on Turkey, and hence they have put in a good amount of money into that ETF, and hence it was launched. As far as the current developments in Turkey are concerned, certainly it was a volatile period with the coup, etc. But we believe the democratic process and the way Turkey works have been ably demonstrated. The country is coming back. And this ETF, of course, is designed for a longer-term investor. But we are very hopeful that it will give a significantly decent return to various investors who are happy to take that risk of that region.
Yeah, and I think undeniably far higher risk investing in one country, particularly with a smaller portfolio like this, than a wider EM bond. And that's all we've got time for this week. So for more on that, for more on emerging markets, both equities and debt, the rate cut and Latin America funds in particular, do read this week's issue, and otherwise have a good weekend.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.